This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
So TED is many things. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design.
That's the T-E-D in TED.
TED all starts with the conference.
Where we bring in scientists, thinkers, philosophers, artists.
Politicians, musicians.
We collect them all of these really diverse speakers at TED, and we give them 18 minutes on stage to give the talk of their lives.
Big ideas that they're passionate about.
Then we film them, we edit them, and we post them on the web
to share with the world.
The whole world.
Here on the TED Radio Hour, we'll hear some of those TED Talks and discuss some big ideas with TED speakers and other guests on today's show.
Behold, the marvel of a human brain.
Our amazing brain, a 3-pound mass that is responsible for virtually everything we do.
The brain is your center of logic and reason. It's your brain's job to carefully weigh your options and make the most logical choice.
So why do we lie or cheat when we know on some level it isn't an okay option? What leads us to act irrationally? And how do our brains systematically misjudge what will make us truly happy?
Scientists and philosophers have sought to understand the brain.
We've asked 3 TED speakers to help us explore our buggy brain and find some answers.
I want to talk to you today a little bit about predictable irrationality.
My name is Dan Ariely. I'm the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. And my TED talk was about how we all have the capacity to cheat just a little bit and at the same time feel quite good about ourselves and our own morality.
We'll speak with Dan Ariely in just a moment. Right now, let's listen to more of his 2009 TED Talk.
My interest in cheating started when Enron came on the scene, exploded all of a sudden, and I started thinking about what is happening here. Is it the case that there is kind of a few apples who are capable of doing these things, or are we talking a more endemic situation that many people are actually capable of behaving this way? So, like we usually do, I decided to do a simple experiment, and here's how it went. If you were in the experiment, I would pass you a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems that everybody could solve, but I wouldn't give you enough time. When the 5 minutes were over, I would say, pass me the sheets of paper and I'll pay you $1 per question. People did this, I would pay people $4 for their task. On average, people would solve 4 problems. Other people I would tempt to cheat. I would pass the sheet of paper. When the 5 minutes were over, I would say, please shred the piece of paper, put the little pieces in your pocket or in your backpack, and tell me how many questions you got correctly. People now solve 7 questions on average. Now, it wasn't as if there was a few bad apples, a few people who cheated a lot. Instead, what we saw is a lot of people who cheat a little bit.
A lot of people who cheated a little bit. I don't know why that was funny. Everybody in the audience giggled a little bit, so did I. Did this experiment live up to your expectations, Dan?
Well, you know, it's kind of a disappointing result on one hand, right? The amount of people who are willing to cheat a little bit is just incredible. On the other hand, people cheat just a little bit. So the amount of people who cheat a lot is incredibly small. This is kind of trying to put the good spin on dishonesty. We've ran almost 30,000 people in many of those tasks, and we found basically about 12 people who cheat a lot. Then we lost maybe $150. On the other hand, we had about 18,000 people who cheated a little bit. And we lost, you know, $30,000, $40,000 to those little cheaters who cheat just a little bit, but there are many of them. And I think that's actually a good reflection of what's happening in society. You know, from time to time, we have big cheaters and they create some damage to society financially. But I think that more damage is created by people who think of themselves as good people and cheat just a little bit here and there, but because it's so prevalent, it basically creates much larger financial devastation.
How does the ease of the cheat affect the numbers who will cheat?
So not that much. You know, the standard economic theory of cheating is that basically there are 3 forces that determine cheating. Is how much money is in the till, right? How much can you take? What's the probability of being caught? And if you're getting caught, what kind of punishment would you get? How much time would you get in prison? And you're supposed to do the cost-benefit analysis and therefore figure out whether you should cheat or not. But when we try to manipulate these three forces, we don't actually see much sensitivity to those things. Instead, what we see is that it's a much more debate within ourselves, that we have kind of an angel voice in our head that tells us, I don't feel so good about this, let's stop. The interesting thing is that this angel voice allows us to get away with a little bit of cheating.
Let's go back to your TED talk where you discuss the idea of the personal fudge factor.
At one hand, we all want to look at ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves. So we don't want to cheat. On the other hand, we can cheat a little bit and still feel good about ourselves. So maybe what is happening is that there's a level of cheating we can't go over, but we can still benefit from cheating at a low degree as long as it doesn't change our impressions about ourselves. We call this like a personal fudge factor. Now, how would you test a personal fudge factor? Initially, we said, what can we do to shrink the fudge factor? So we got people to the lab, and we said, we have two tasks for you today. First, we asked half the people to recall either 10 books they read in high school or to recall the 10 commandments. And then we tempted them with cheating. Turns out, the people who tried to recall the 10 commandments, and in our sample, nobody could recall the 10 commandments, but those people who tried to recall the 10 commandments, given the opportunity to cheat, did not cheat at all. It wasn't that the more religious people, the people who remembered more of the commandments, cheated less, and the less religious people, the people who couldn't remember almost any commandment, cheated more. The moment people thought about trying to recall the 10 commandments, they stopped cheating. In fact, even when we give self-declared atheists the task of swearing on the Bible and we give them a chance to cheat, they don't cheat at all. Now, 10 commandments is something that is hard to bring into the education system, so we said, why don't we get people to sign the honor code? So we got people to sign. I understand that this short survey falls under the MIT honor code. Then they shredded it. No cheating whatsoever. And this is particularly interesting because MIT doesn't have an honor code.
So, Dan, what outside factors can help shape someone's fudge factor?
Yeah, so there's factors that make the fudge factor higher and there are factors that make it lower. And if you think about it, it's basically about the ability to justify what we're doing, right? We have this incentive to be bad or to be dishonest. And the question is, can we tell ourselves a story that would make it more okay? So the things that make it go up, make the fudge factor become larger and make it easier for us to be dishonest, is, for example, the fact that we see other people around us doing the same thing. Or when we're doing it for a good cause, right? It will be a bit like Robin Hood, right? We're doing it, it's immoral, yes, but we're doing it for something good. Another thing that helps a lot to be more dishonest and feel good about it is that when we deal with stuff that is distant from money, and this, by the way, is one of the thoughts that worries me the most because we are moving into a cashless society, right? If you think about it, what keeps us honest is being close to cash. What happens when we move to things like stocks or stock options or mortgage-backed securities or electronic wallets? Would those mediums of storage of value allow people to be more dishonest and at the same time justified to themselves?
Dan, let's get back to your TED Talk.
I did the same experiment as I described to you before. A third of the people, we passed the sheet, they gave it back to us. A third of the people, we passed it, they shredded it, they came to us and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X dollars. A third of the people, when they finished shredding the piece of paper, they came to us and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X tokens. We did not pay them with dollars, we paid them with something else. And then they took this something else, they walked 12 feet to the side and exchanged it for dollars. Think about the following intuition. How bad would you feel about taking a pencil from work home compared to how bad would you feel about taking 10 cents from a petty cash box? These things feel very differently. Would being a step removed from cash for a few seconds by being paid by a token make a difference? Our subjects doubled their cheating. So what have we learned from this about cheating? We've learned that a lot of people can cheat. They cheat just by a little bit. When we remind people about their morality, they cheat less. When we get bigger distance from cheating, from the object of money, for example, people cheat more. And when we see things of cheating around us, particularly if it's a part of our in-group, cheating goes up. Now, if we think about this in terms of the stock market, think about what happens. What happens in a situation when you create something where you pay people a lot of money to see reality in a slightly distorted way? Would they not be able to see it this way? Of course they would. What happens when you do other things, like you remove things from money? You call them stock or stock option, derivatives, mortgage-backed securities. Could it be that with those more distant things, it's not a token for one second, it's something that is many steps removed from money for much longer time, could it be that people would cheat even more? And what happened to the social environment when people see other people behave around them? I think all of those forces worked in a very bad way in the stock market.
The big theme of your talk is that we should challenge our intuitions, that we should think differently about cheating, because the way we originally think about it, it may not be the case. You suggest that we will all do better if we test our intuitions. Why?
So we have very naive intuitions about our own operations. And I think in cheating is one example for this. We think very much in the economic model. We think that why people cheat. Well, they cheat because they want something else. What's stopping them? The fear of getting to prison and getting punished and getting caught. So we have this very mechanistic view of the reasons why people are doing it. And not only do we have this view, that's the view that we implement. So you say, what are the punishing policies? What are they based on? What is the educational system based on? What is the legal system based on? What are the policies that companies create? How do parents teach their kids? All of those things are based on assumptions about what's causing misbehavior, and they're based on very, very simple assumptions. And if we have an incredibly simplistic view of human nature, and which is not correct, we're not going to get to the behavior that we want. So I think in all of those cases, it behooves us to have a bit more humility, to question our assumption of human beings, and to basically try to experiment a bit more before we implement all kinds of policies.
Dan Ariely, thanks so much for talking with us on the TED Radio Hour.
My pleasure.
Dan Ariely's new book is called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. You can read more about Ariely's research, and you can watch more TED Talks about how our mind works. Go to ted.npr.org. Coming up, you're ready to part ways with an itchy old sweater in the back of your closet. But then you find out that George Clooney had worn it.
I came here for you.
You're definitely going to want that sweater back now. The Deep Roots of Pleasure, just ahead on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Here's a recording of a musician in a subway station. To set the scene, he's a youngish man with his violin case open at his feet. Commuters are rushing by. What do you think? Would you drop a quarter in his case? Okay, what if I told you that this Bach piece is considered one of the most challenging ever written for violin? Then would you stop and listen for a minute? Maybe drop in a dollar? Now, what if I told you the performer is Joshua Bell, a violin virtuoso who's recorded over 30 CDs, performed at the White House, and was named Classical Musician of the Year by Billboard magazine? That day, he looked like an ordinary street musician.
The question is, how much would people like Joshua Bell, the music of Joshua Bell, if they didn't know they were listening to Joshua Bell?
It was all an experiment by the Washington Post to answer that question. Well, the answer? Bell made about $32 and was mostly ignored by passersby.
Apparently, to really enjoy the music of Joshua Bell, you have to know you're listening to Joshua Bell.
That's psychologist Paul Bloom from his 2011 TED Talk. Bloom studies the tricks our minds play to determine why we like some things more than others, even if they are essentially the same thing. Like a glass of wine, a painting, or the music of a street performer. We'll talk to Professor Bloom in a moment, but first, here's the beginning of his TED Talk. He tells a story of an unusual and terrible man.
This is Hermann Göring. Göring was Hitler's second-in-command in World War II, his designated successor. And like Hitler, Göring fancied himself a collector of art. He went through Europe through World War II, stealing, extorting, and occasionally buying various paintings for his collection. And what he really wanted was something by Vermeer. Hitler had two of them, and he didn't have any. So he finally found an art dealer, a Dutch art dealer named Han van Meegeren, who sold him a wonderful Vermeer for the cost of what would now be $10 million. And it was his favorite artwork ever. World War II came to an end, and Goering was captured, tried at Nuremberg, and ultimately sentenced to death. Then the Allied forces went through his collections and found the paintings and went after the people who sold it to him. And at some point, the Dutch police came in Amsterdam and arrested van Meegeren. Van Meegeren was charged with the crime of treason, which is itself punishable by death. 6 weeks into his prison sentence, van Meegeren confessed. But he didn't confess to treason. He said, "I did not sell a great masterpiece to that Nazi. I painted it myself. I'm a forger." Nobody believed him. And he said, "I'll prove it. Bring me a canvas and some paint, and I will paint a Vermeer much better than I sold that disgusting Nazi. I also need alcohol and morphine, because it's the only way I can work." So they brought him in. He painted a beautiful Vermeer. And then the charges of treason were dropped. He had a lesser charge of forgery, got a year sentence, and died a hero to the Dutch people. There's a lot more to be said about van Meegeren, but I want to turn now to Goering, who's pictured here being interrogated at Nuremberg. Now, Goering was, by all accounts, a terrible man. Even for a Nazi, he was a terrible man. His American interrogators described him as an amicable psychopath. But you could feel sympathy for the reaction he had when he was told that his favorite painting was actually a forgery. According to his biographer, he looked as if for the first time he had discovered there was evil in the world.
So we have here a Nazi who, upon finding out his painting isn't real, looked as if for the first time he discovered there was evil in the world. One of the best laugh lines ever at a TED Talk, but true. Paul, what does this tell us? What do we learn from this Goering tale?
Well, our response to forgeries is a huge puzzle. You might think that the pleasure you get from a painting depends on its color and its shape and its patterns, what it looks like. And if that's right, then it shouldn't matter whether it's an original or forgery. It shouldn't matter at all who created it. But the mind doesn't work that way. It matters to all of us. In my own work, I find for young children, it matters where the painting came from, who made it. And I think that tells us something interesting about what we like. I think it suggests that when it comes to a pleasure like the pleasure we get from paintings, we're exquisitely sensitive to their origin, to who made it, to how it was made. And this suggests that artistic pleasure isn't a simple sensory matter. It's a highly intellectual matter, and I think it's a nice case study of an argument I try to make, which is that we're natural-born essentialists.
Will you please define essentialism for me?
Essentialism is the idea that there is more to an object than its physical structure. And this moreness, this essence, is what matters. So the physical features of a painting might be its color and its shape and its size, but the essence of the painting is its invisible history that gave rise to it. For a glass of wine, the physical properties are its chemical structures, which the tongue and the nose respond to, but its essence is its origin, it's where it came from, who made it.
One of the best experiments, or I say it's the best experiment, I guess, for the participants, was the wine experiment.
How do you get adults to really enjoy wine? It's very simple. Pour it from an expensive bottle. There are now dozens, perhaps hundreds of studies showing that if you believe you're drinking the expensive stuff, it tastes better to you. This was recently done with a neuroscientific twist. They get people into an fMRI scanner, and while they're lying there through a tube, they get to sip wine. In front of them on a screen is information about the wine. Everybody, of course, drinks exactly the same wine. But if you believe you're drinking expensive stuff, parts of the brain associated with pleasure and reward light up like a Christmas tree. It's not just then you say it's more pleasurable, you say you like it more, you really experience it in a different way.
The wine example is so interesting. It brought to mind the two-buck chuck phenomenon. It's a wine that was at Trader Joe's, and it was basically a cheap wine that wasn't sold like a cheap wine because it was pretty good. And I wondered if any reality can jog your original notion of something.
So the Tupac Shakur story is interesting in a couple of ways. So one thing is, it points out that it's not as simple as the more something costs, the more pleasure you get from it. People are complicated, and there are some cases where things will flip around. Often, your essentialist view, the way you think things should be, and your perceptual experience will clash. In some cases, we really can override it, or at least we can in some way influence our essentialist verdict. We could say, look, that wine is really cheap, but damn, it's good. Or that wine, conversely, that wine is hugely expensive, but it's very disappointing. We're capable of doing that. But I would suggest that we're always swayed by history. The fact that Tupac Shakur is Tupac will make it taste less good once you know what it is than if you believed it was 200 buck chuck.
I'm speaking with Paul Bloom. He's a professor of cognitive psychology at Yale University, and he's sharing with us some of the science behind the particular bug in our brain that affects how we enjoy pleasure. Paul, in your TED Talk, you highlight the role that celebrity plays in the history of an object. Let's listen.
So in one of our experiments, we asked people to name a famous person who they adored, a living person they adored. So one answer was George Clooney. Then we asked them, how much would you pay for George Clooney's sweater? And the answer is a fair amount, more than you would pay for a brand new sweater, or a sweater owned by somebody who you didn't adore. Then we asked other groups of subjects, we gave them different restrictions and different conditions. So for instance, we told some people, look, you can buy the sweater, but you can't tell anybody you own it, and you can't resell it. That drops the value a bit, suggesting that that's one reason why we like it. But what really causes an effect is you tell people, look, you could resell it, you could boast about it, but before it gets to you, it's thoroughly washed. That causes a huge drop in the value. As my wife put it, you've washed away the Clooney cooties.
So once the history of something is gone, washed away, literally in this case, will our minds ever allow us to enjoy the object again with the same fervor and excitement?
You could enjoy the object again. You might enjoy it even more, but you'll have to enjoy it for different reasons. You may enjoy it because it develops another history. If the history of being owned by a celebrity washes off, but it develops a great personal significance, in some way that could add a different sort of value to it. The case of forgery is an interesting one. So the Van Meegeren forgery that Gehring got sucked in by is actually now quite a famous object in and of itself. And there are some rare and interesting cases where we discover things are not what they appear to be, but later on they get their own value, maybe in part because of their importance and significance in having fooled us.
So much have we been talking about our positive associations with something, a sweater of a celebrity, maybe you have a Broadway ticket from the premiere where the big star was. What happens when the object has importance but the association is negative? Perhaps the coat you were wearing when you were in the World Trade Center and you escaped on September 11th. Does it work the same way?
There it's complicated. Part of the motivation for our sweater study was actually previous work by Paul Rozin, where he asked people if they wanted to wear the sweater of Adolf Hitler or, put on Jeffrey Dahmer sweatpants, that sort of thing. Touch objects, make contact with objects that are associated with notorious and terrible people.
I just got creeped out thinking yes. about that.
and people are. People. He finds that people say, I'd rather not. But I think the value is very different than for George Clooney's sweater. For George Clooney's sweater, the value is from the contact. For something like a Hitler sweater, I think the value is the notoriety. And we have some evidence for this. So in the same studies we tested for the George Clooney sweater effect, we also asked about Bernie Madoff's sweater. Now, there, the results turned out differently. Some people wouldn't pay anything for it. They wouldn't want it. They were like you, repulsed by it. But others would pay a lot for it. But when we probed them, the reason why they would pay a lot for it wasn't physical contact. They didn't mind if it was washed. It was being able to resell it and being able to boast about it.
Paul, in your talk, you also use as an example the case of Marla Olmsted. Explain to folks listening to the show what happened with Marla Olmsted.
So Marla Olmsted is a young artist who paints in a very abstract style. And her work got a huge amount of attention, was sold for you know, considerable sums.
When you say young, you mean...
I mean young. That's the trick. She was 3 years old. The interesting point about Marla Olmsted is her family made the mistake of inviting the television program 60 Minutes 2 into their house to film her painting. And they then reported that her father was coaching her. When this came out on television, the value of her art dropped to nothing. It was the same art physically, but the history had changed. There's a lovely documentary on this, and at the end, there's a town meeting, and a man who's very involved in the selling of art says, this is ridiculous. Why should it make a difference? If you liked the art before, you should like it now. But the producer, the director of the documentary, stood up and said something which I think is exactly right. He said, look, when you buy art, you're buying a story. When you appreciate art, you're appreciating a story. And the story had changed. Before the show came out, people thought they were getting one thing. After the show came out, they thought they were getting another thing. And it made a difference.
You as a scientist, what do you see in this story?
I see it as a demonstration of something we could see in the laboratory and we see in many other cases, which is that when shown an object or given a food or shown a face, people's assessment of it, how much they like it, how valuable it is deeply affected by what you tell them about it. We find that even children will assess art differently if they think it was made by one person versus by another. We find that adults are profoundly affected when seeing the same artwork, whether it was painted by as an original, as a forgery. When seeing a sculpture, it matters to them whether the artist touched it or used tools on it. There's dozens, probably hundreds of demonstrations that for something as simple as a painting or a very simple, like a line drawing, what you think of it is influenced by the circumstances. And the Marla Olmsted case, I think, is a dramatic real-world illustration of that.
It makes me wonder if you can teach a child good taste, what to find pleasurable. Please don't find that pink flamingo on the lawn. Instead, wouldn't it be lovely to have this Miro print in your room?
We know you can do that. We know that because pleasure develops, tastes develop. And tastes develop in part because of experience. And a parent, for instance, could give their child different experiences. So one example of this is classical music. For a lot of classical music, nobody likes it at the beginning. But you come to like it, you come to appreciate it as you understand more about it. And I think that speaks to a moral I didn't emphasize enough in my TED Talk, and I'm glad to have the chance to talk about it now, which is a lot of people think of this as a glitch, as sort of a faulty system. If we were perfect beings, we wouldn't be influenced by all of this other information. But I don't view it that way at all. And I think in general, the best demonstration that these aren't mistakes is that what it is to have a good sense of pleasure, what it is to be an expert, to be a mature individual, is actually have a lot of knowledge and understanding. In the real world, being sensitive to these considerations is actually very smart.
You'll have more pleasure in your life.
You will have more pleasure in your life. I'm very much of a professor, so my advice, people sometimes, since I wrote a book on it and gave the TED Talk, people sometimes ask, how do you get more pleasure out of life? And my answer is extremely pedantic. It's study more. Anything that you don't understand, unless it's a sugar donut, is really going to be sort of say, I don't get it. So that the key to enjoying wine isn't just to guzzle a lot of real expensive wine. It's to learn about wine. Music, learn about music.
Art history.
Exactly. Art history is basically a mechanism for enhancing artistic pleasure. The more you know about it, the more you'll like.
Paul Bloom is a professor at Yale. He got his PhD in cognitive psychology from MIT. Paul, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The film Professor Bloom mentions is called My Kid Could Paint That. And it shows a painful example of our ability to assign value to something and then immediately devalue it. In this case, it was a little girl's art.
The paintings are unbelievable. Even if a 3 or 4 year old didn't do them, you'd like them.
Yeah.
The fact that she is 4 makes it really incredible.
Right.
Of course, we know now that it does matter whether a 4 year old created those abstract works. It certainly mattered to the film's director, Amir Barlev.
I would hear at every Q&A I did, who cares if the dad did them? Isn't it the same exact painting whether the dad did it or not? And, you know, my answer was always, no, it's not the same painting. The story of a piece of art is part of what people are buying into. It illuminated a lot in terms of story. And I think that we don't give enough credit to how important story is in our lives. Story is actually more important than actually like well-being in some ways. Like, I mean, what's that Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl? He talks about how the people in concentration camps, if they couldn't make meaning of their life, that was really the death of them. It was more important than anything in terms of survival. And that's an extreme case, obviously. But I think that people don't give enough credit to how important story is in giving us pleasure and in giving us meaning.
Amir Bar-Lev directed the 2007 film My Kid Could Paint That. You can find out more about the film and more about Paul Bloom at our website, ted.npr.org. Coming up next on the program, the peculiar signals our brains send to keep us happy when we're in it for the long haul.
I mean, you go out on a date with a guy and he picks his nose. You don't go out on another date. You're married to a guy and he picks his nose. Yeah, he has a heart of gold. Don't touch the fruitcake, right? You find a way to be happy with what's happened.
Stay tuned. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. On the show, we feature a number of TED Talks where a speaker shares a powerful idea with an audience gathered at a TED conference. Today, we're talking about how our brain works in very marvelous and unexpected ways, a topic which has been popular at TED.
Here is this 3-pound mass of jelly, and it can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
This brain is an incredibly complicated circuit.
Made up of billions of active neurons.
We chart it, we've drawn it, we've mapped it.
We're going to be able to see a child's brain as they learn to speak and read, as they solve a math problem, as they have an idea.
We are the first generation that's going to be able to enter into the human mind and brain. Where will we take it?
In 2 million years, the human brain has nearly tripled in mass, going from the 1 1/4-pound brain of our ancestor Habilis to the almost 3-pound meatloaf that everybody here has between their ears.
That's Dan Gilbert.
I'm a professor of psychology at Harvard University.
And his TED Talk explores one of the great mysteries of the human mind,
which is its ability to make us feel better when we feel bad.
We'll talk more with Dan Gilbert in just a few minutes. Right now, let's get back to his TED Talk and the evolution of what he described as that 3-pound meatloaf. While the analogy is a little bit Hannibal Lecter to me, it is vivid. According to Gilbert, when tripled in size, the brain didn't just get 3 times bigger, it actually took on a new structure. Here's Professor Gilbert at TED.
And one of the main reasons that our brain got so big is because it got a new part, called the frontal lobe, and particularly a part called the prefrontal cortex. Now, what does a prefrontal cortex do for you that should justify the entire architectural overhaul of the human skull in the blink of evolutionary time? Well, turns out the prefrontal cortex does lots of things, but one of the most important things it does is it is an experience simulator. You know, pilots practice in flight simulators so that they don't make real mistakes in planes. Human beings have this marvelous adaptation that they can actually have experiences in their heads before they try them out in real life. This is a trick that none of our ancestors could do, that no other animal can do quite like we can. It's a marvelous adaptation. It's up there with opposable thumbs and standing upright in language as one of the things that got our species out of the trees and into the shopping mall. Now, all of you have done this. I mean, you know, Ben and Jerry's doesn't have liver and onion ice cream, and it's not because they whipped some up, tried it, and went yuck. It's because from, without leaving your armchair, you can simulate that flavor and say yuck before you make it. The research that my laboratory has been doing, that economists and psychologists around the country have been doing, have revealed something really quite startling to us. Something we call the impact bias, which is the tendency for the simulator to work badly.
for the simulator to make you believe that different outcomes are more different than in fact they really are. From field studies to laboratory studies, we see that winning or losing an election, gaining or losing a romantic partner, getting or not getting a promotion, passing or not passing a college test, on and on, have far less impact, less intensity, and much less duration than people expect them to have. In fact, a recent study, this almost floors me, a recent study showing how major life traumas affect people suggests that if it happened over 3 months ago, with only a few exceptions, it has no impact whatsoever on your happiness. Why? Because happiness can be synthesized. Sir Thomas Browne wrote in 1642, "I am the happiest man alive. I have that in me that can convert poverty to riches, adversity to prosperity. I am more invulnerable than Achilles. Fortune hath not one place to hit me." What kind of remarkable machinery does this guy have in his head? Well, it turns out it's precisely the same remarkable machinery that all of us have. Human beings have something that we might think of as a psychological immune system, a system of cognitive processes, largely non-conscious cognitive processes, that help them change their views of the world so that they can feel better about the worlds in which they find themselves. Like Sir Thomas, you have this machine. Unlike Sir Thomas, you seem not to know it.
Now we have Dan Gilbert in real time joining us to follow up on his TED Talk. Dan, are you saying that we are wired to be happy with whatever hand we're dealt?
We are wired to be resilient. We're wired to find what's good in the current situation. It's good for us to be optimistic. It's good for us to feel good about our lives. Everybody wants to feel that way, but you can imagine from an evolutionary perspective, an animal that cowers in the corner, sobbing and fearful, is not an animal that mates, explores, discovers, finds food. So we have been built to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and soldier on. Truly, every generation of people has known this about human beings. It's just a bit of wisdom that seems to have been lost in the 20th century as we began to regard ourselves as, you know, kind of a field of fragile flowers that needs to go running to a therapist every time our shoelaces break. In fact, that's not what our species is all about. We are a species that's able to suffer a great deal of trauma and muddle through anyway.
Dan, let's listen in to your TED Talk.
We synthesize happiness, but we think happiness is a thing to be found. Now, you don't need me to tell you too many examples of people synthesizing happiness, I suspect, though I'm going to show you some experimental evidence. I took a copy of the New York Times and tried to find some instances of people synthesizing happiness, and here are three guys synthesizing happiness. I'm so much better off physically, financially, emotionally, in almost every other way. I don't have 1 minute's regret. It was a glorious experience. I believe it turned out for the best. Who are these characters who are so damn happy? Well, the first one is Jim Wright. Some of you are old enough to remember. He was the chairman of the House of Representatives, and he resigned in disgrace when this young Republican named Newt Gingrich found out about a shady book deal he had done. He lost everything. He lost his money, he lost his power. What does he have to say all these years later about it? I am so much better off physically, financially, mentally, and in almost every other way. What other way would there be to be better off? Vegetably, minerally, animally? He's pretty much covered in there. Maurice Bickham is somebody you've never heard of. Maurice Bickham uttered these words. Upon being released, he was 78 years old. He'd spent 37 years in Louisiana State Penitentiary for a crime he didn't commit. He was ultimately exonerated at the age of 78 through DNA evidence. And what did he have to say about his experience? I don't have 1 minute's regret. It was a glorious experience. Glorious! This guy is not saying, well, yeah, there's some nice guys. They had a gym. It's glorious, a word we usually reserve for something like a religious experience. Harry S. Langerman uttered these words, and he's somebody you might have known but didn't, because in 1949 he read a little article in the paper about a hamburger stand owned by these two brothers named McDonald's, and he thought, that's a really neat idea, so he went to find them. They said, we'd give you a franchise on this for $3,000. Harry went back to New York, asked his brother, who was an investment banker, to loan him the $3,000, and his brother's immortal words were, you idiot, nobody eats hamburgers. He wouldn't lend him the money, and of course, 6 months later, Ray Kroc had exactly the same idea. It turns out people do eat hamburgers, and Ray Kroc, for a while, became the richest man in America.
I just want to get your opinion on this one. Do you think Secretary of State Clinton wakes up and thinks, I'm really glad I'm not president. Ooh, glad that didn't happen.
Yes.
You do?
I absolutely do. I believe there are days where she wakes up and says, thank God my life has gone this direction rather than the direction I wanted it to go. Now, I don't mean to say that the day after she lost that nomination, she woke up and said, my gosh, I think it's all for the best. We would all worry about her mental health if she adopted that new attitude that quickly. But I do believe that most of the time she thinks that it did work out for the best for her. I think if she's like most people, she's found lots of ways in which there is good in that negative event, and she doesn't feel nearly as bad as she expected to feel if she were asked to predict beforehand.
There may be some listeners who aren't buying your answer to that last question, so this is the perfect place to return to your TED Talk where you take on the doubters.
When people synthesize happiness, we all smile at them, but we kind of roll our eyes and say, yeah, right, you never really wanted the job. Oh, yeah, right, you really didn't have that much in common with her, and you figured that out just about the time she threw the engagement ring in your face. We smirk because we believe that synthetic happiness is not of the same quality as what we might call natural happiness. What are these terms? Natural happiness is what we get when we get what we wanted, and synthetic happiness is what we make when we don't get what we wanted. And in our society, we have a strong belief that synthetic happiness is of an inferior kind. Why do we have that belief? Well, it's very simple. What kind of economic engine would keep churning if we believed that not getting what we want could make us just as happy as getting it?
So I'm wondering, is this a capitalist conspiracy?
Well, Adam Smith certainly thought so. The father of free market capitalism was very clear when he said that people must have the illusion that more products and services will make them happy or else the economy grinds to a halt. But I don't think it's a conspiracy foisted upon us by a star chamber of capitalists. I think it's a conspiracy of brains. It's the way our brain naturally thinks, that if we get what we want, it'll be better than if we don't. That's the basic belief that keeps us moving forward, trying to get one thing to happen rather than the other.
We are listening to and having a conversation with Dan Gilbert. His TED Talk was called Why Are We Happy? Let's listen to some more.
I want to suggest to you that synthetic happiness is every bit as real and enduring as the kind of happiness you stumble upon when you get exactly what you were aiming for. Now, I'm a scientist, so I'm going to do this not with rhetoric, but by marinating you in a little bit of data. Here's an experiment we did at Harvard. We created a photography course, a black and white photography course, and we allowed students to come in and learn how to use a darkroom. So we gave them cameras, they went around campus, they took 12 pictures of their favorite professors in their dorm room and their dog and all the other things they wanted to have Harvard memories of. They bring us the camera, we make up a contact sheet, they figure out which are the two best pictures, and we now spend 6 hours teaching them about darkrooms, and they blow two of them up, and they have two gorgeous 8x10 glossies of meaningful things to them, and we say, which one would you like to give up? They say, I have to give one up. Oh, yes, we need one as evidence of the class project. So you have to give me one. You have to make a choice. You get to keep one, and I get to keep one. Now, there are two conditions in this experiment. In one case, the students are told, but you know, if you want to change your mind, I'll always have the other one here, and in the next 4 days before I actually mail it to headquarters, I'll be glad to swap it out with you. In fact, I'll come to your dorm room and give me an email. Better yet, I'll check with you. You ever want to change your mind, it's totally returnable. The other half of the students are told exactly the opposite. Make your choice, and by the way, the mail is going out, gosh, in 2 minutes to England. Your picture will be winging its way over the Atlantic. You will never see it again. Now, half of the students in each of these conditions are asked to make predictions about how much they're going to come to like the picture that they keep and the picture they leave behind. Other students are just sent back to their little dorm rooms, and they are measured over the next 3 to 6 days on their liking and satisfaction with the pictures. Look at what we find. First of all, here's what students...
I want you to tell me what we find. I want the not-TED version, the not-condensed version. What did you find from this experiment?
Well, what we found was actually quite condensable because it was awfully simple. People who are allowed to return their pictures, who are allowed to change their mind later, weren't nearly as happy with what they got as those who had made an irrevocable choice. And we've seen that in many studies since the TED Talk. people who make choices that are forever, that are permanent, that have no opportunity for change, end up being happier with what they've chosen.
Why is that?
Well, it's not hard to understand, and once again, our friend Adam Smith predicted this right on the money. He said that we tend to rationalize, but we only tend to rationalize our outcomes when those outcomes can't be changed. You know, if you find yourself, you bought a sweater, and you think maybe it makes you look fat, you bring it back to the store. You don't say to yourself, I don't believe it makes me look fat. In fact, it makes me look quite trim. You don't rationalize the sweater when you can, in fact, return it. It's only when we're stuck with things that rationalization kicks in. So that's why we showed in this experiment that when people were unable to change their minds, the rationalization processes kicked in, and they decided that the photograph they'd chosen was indeed the best photograph. When people do have the opportunity to change their mind, they worry themselves to death about it. Gee, I wonder if I made the right decision. Was it the good one? Was it the bad one? Should I bring it back? Should I return it? So we're very fond of saying that we should always keep doors open, preserve degrees of freedom, but there is a great deal of happiness that comes from burning bridges.
Adam Smith is a running theme here, and you conclude your TED Talk with a quote from Smith.
This is worth contemplating. The great source of both the misery and disorders of human life seems to arise from overrating the difference between one permanent situation and another. Some of these situations may no doubt deserve to be preferred to others, but none of them can deserve to be pursued with that passionate ardor which drives us to violate the rules either of prudence or of justice, or to corrupt the future tranquility of our minds either by shame from the remembrance of our own folly or by remorse for the horror of our own injustice. In other words, yes, some things are better than others. We should have preferences that lead us into one future over another. But when those preferences drive us too hard and too fast because we have overrated the difference between these futures, we are at risk. When our ambition is bounded, it leads us to work joyfully. When our ambition is unbounded, it leads us to lie, to cheat, to steal, to hurt others, to sacrifice things of real value. When our fears are bounded, we're prudent, we're cautious, we're thoughtful. When our fears are unbounded and overblown, we're reckless and we're cowardly. The lesson I want to leave you with from these data is that our longings and our worries are both to some degree overblown because we have within us the capacity to manufacture the very commodity we are constantly chasing when we choose experience. Thank you.
Dan, at the beginning of your talk, you referred to the psychological immune system in our brains, a system of cognitive processes that protect us from becoming unhappy or depressed. Now, is there anything a person can do to strengthen their psychological immune system? Is there any echinacea for the mind?
Well, before we decide that we need an echinacea for the mind, a way to strengthen the psychological immune system, we ought to ask what the dangers are of having one that's too strong. Because we know there's dangers of having one that's too weak. People who are depressed have a weak psychological immune system. That is, they tend to clutch defeat from the jaws of victory rather than the other way around. But just like a physiological immune system, you don't want it to be too weak, but you also don't want it to be too strong. None of us wants to be the person or even know the person who is constantly figuring out ways in which the things that went bad in their life are actually all for the better. So it might just be that the psychological immune system works just exactly as it should, helping us choose when there are two ways to view something that are equally reasonable, helping us choose the most positive way. But we don't want to be lost in illusion and delusion, convincing ourselves that everything that happens to us is for the best, everything we say and do is good.
Dan Gilbert, thank you so much for being with us on the TED Radio Hour.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dan Gilbert is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. You can find links to his research and to his book, Stumbling on Happiness. Go to ted.npr.org. And you can watch another one of Dan's TED Talks and many more about how the mind works. Go to ted.com. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, and Sam Greenspan, with help from Neil Ellis and Sean Phillips. Special thanks to our partners at TED, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, Darren Triff, and Chris Anderson. Also, thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.